Blog Talk Radio.
This is Patty Holstrand, and we're on live. This is KWOD Radio. And this is our second day in our brand new programming for the year, 2013. For those of you who thought we would all be gone by December 21st, guess what? We're still here. So, it's only appropriate on the 13th of February to talk about vampires. So here we thought we were dead or dying, and now we're talking about the undead. We're waiting on Alexander to come on board here. Until then, let's read about what he's all about. I talked to Alexander back in September, or no, I'm sorry, September, it was July of last year, early July before 4th of July, about his other book, and Depth of Deception was what we talked about. It had to do with Titanic suddenly resurfacing, and the mystery, and bizarre case in time travel. Of course, as most of you know, time travel is my favorite subject. So, it's definitely an interesting read. You guys need to take a look at that. Under the chat, just below the information about the program, you can write your question in right there, so that way I can ask Alexander those questions. And we'll talk a little bit about his Titanic murder mystery before we get into his series on Dracula and his vampire story. So with that, I believe we have our main guest of honor here. And is that Alexander?
Hello, yes.
Hey, Alexander, how you doing?
Not too bad. How are you doing?
Good.
Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you. I can hear you. I think.
Okay.
And I gave a little bit of, you know, we talked back in July, believe it or not. It was July.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
I went back and double-checked to say, when did I talk to you? Yeah, it was July 2nd. And we had talked about your Depth of Deception, the Titanic murder mystery.
That's correct.
Which was published earlier last year.
Yeah, we published to coincide around the centennial anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic.
Good timing. So tell us a little bit of how that's been going.
It's not too bad. Surprisingly, the e-book sales are doing much better than print sales. But you know, it's a whole new world in the publishing industry as far as you know, with the whole e-book. So it's quite popular, and the feedback or the reviews from all over have been very positive. And, and it's kind of cool to get it from a review from Italy or somewhere else, So, people I have no idea, So it's been good that way.
Yeah, it's publishing industry is really just flip-flopped, and it's you're right. Yeah, but it has opened up the market, as you say, into other countries, which is unusual. And apparently, it can even take us into China and into Asia, so that would be interesting.
Yes. That's also relatively new, I believe. So.
Just to let everybody know, you can always come in anytime. I, again, have the chat open. If you are just, you know about Alexander's work or want to talk about vampires, but don't want to come on to radio, just go ahead and put your question or comment into the chat, and I'll definitely let Alexander know what it is that you would like to say. Otherwise, I'm always open to guest calls. Please call 714-242-5145. I can imagine that this kind of subject definitely can get some interesting people and feedback. So we definitely would like to have you on board and talk, because after all, we're live, so should you be. So, let's talk about the dead.
Sorry?
What got you involved with the vampire story?
Oh, really, it actually goes back a long time ago. I actually first came up with the idea of doing kind of a modern day sequel as a TV series idea, and this was back in 1992. So that's how far back this goes. And I had, you know, I wrote a pilot episode and the first couple of episodes, as well as they call a series Bible, which would have, you know, the character backgrounds, how it tied into the original book, and then the original book by Bram Stoker, and then it's kind of the storylines and the story arc for the first, like, kind of 5 years. And the, you know, when I was sort of pitching it, the Dracula seems to have a very kind of a campy stereotype to him now. You know, with the cape and the you know, thick accent and the widow's peak hairstyle, you know, slick back. So it was hard to get past that at first. So, you know, I shot a promotional video and had got Mickey Rooney to narrate as Van Helsing, Professor Van Helsing from the past, you know, as, you know, how Dracula could have survived from the novel, because I found kind of a loophole in it just depends on interpretation in Bram Stoker's last chapter, so kind of left it open for a sequel. And so I went with that, and then I shot this promotional video just to kind of show Dracula is not, you know, the it'll be a little bit more darker, more to what, you know, Bram Stoker originally wrote. You know, has, you know, he wasn't a nice character, and he was very dark and very intimidating. And so I wanted to kind of go back to that monster route. And me living here in Toronto, you know, when I was pitching it around Toronto, there was a vampire series being shot here at that time called Forever Night. Now, this goes back a while, so I don't know how many vampire fans remember Forever Night.
Yeah,
But that was shooting here in Toronto at the time. And the Toronto, Canadians generally, we have a reputation of being nice. And we try to be nice. And I got the nice response. Well, there's already a vampire series shooting in Toronto. So, you know, we don't want to compete against that. Which is a very strange mentality, and because, you know, by comparison, you know, you get in the United States, you know, you get one successful kind of TV show, then everybody copies it, you know, that style. Good example, CSI. You know, how many
CSI
copycats have there been?
Yeah.
And so then, so like I said, I tried to shoot, I shot this video, and then I started pitching it down to the United States, and it got some good feedback. They liked the video. They just found it to be a little too dark for television, and thought it was, you know. So I'd gone to the opposite extreme as far as they were concerned. I tried to show that he wasn't campy, but they thought he was a little too dark. And then the following year, The X-Files came out on TV, and which completely changed, you know, what darkness is on television. And then shortly after that, Buffy came out, and then it was like, well, do you have any kung fu vampires? No, that's not what we were going with. So I kind of shelved it for a while, and you know, although I had worked on other kind of Dracula projects, even stage productions, That had always kind of been in the back of my mind. I never got back to that. And, you know, and then now there's been a lot more vampire shows on, you know, you got True Blood, you got The Vampire Diaries, you know, and then you get some really good shows like Walking Dead, which is not vampires, but we're going in, again into that
monsters,
that
yeah.
genre. And mm-hmm. and I look at these and go, and mine was dark, because mine
right.
actually, if the promo video I shot looks so tame and so pale in comparison to what television has evolved since, you know, over the last 20 years. And so I thought, well, you know, I didn't want to try to start going that and pitching that all over again, you know, then trying to compete against some, you know, very good established shows right now. And it would just mm-hmm. seem like a copycat, even though I came up with this 20 years ago. I was working on another writing project, and I do, you know, I had hit a moment of writer's block, and I do what a lot of writers do when they hit writer's block and or, you know, trying to, you know, waste time, they go onto Facebook. And so I was, you know, just sort of tooling around on Facebook, making comments to, you know, whatever. And there was one post somebody had posted, and there was some interesting banter going back and forth. And what it was is irrelevant. But as I was kind of watching it or reading it, it occurred to me, I was reminded of why Bram Stoker's novel, Dracula, has never been properly translated to film, which is kind of impossible, because Bram Stoker, for those of you who have read Bram Stoker's novel, know that it's written in journals and diaries and journals and letters and telegrams, and you follow the story through this interesting way of communication, just through communication, correspondence, or introspective journal writing. So mm-hmm. it's all very narrative and all inside the head, and, you know, it isn't until the characters, the heroes, compare notes, literally, that they realize what they're up against. Meanwhile, the audience knows, you know, right from the beginning, you know, what it is and what Dracula is, but it takes them a while to figure it out, and there's just little bits of clues that everybody has, and once they put all those clues together, you know, can they successfully defeat Dracula? And so that's why that's never been kind of told, or it's hard to do that on film, because, like I said, it's all very, very narrative, very, very inside the head. And then as I'm reading this Facebook banter that I was kind of involved in, this is the new form of communication that, you know, we have emails, we have blogs, we have Twitter, we have Facebook, we have all sorts of interesting ways of communicating now. And that just kind of mulled over my head, and then I took my pilot script and I just took the first scene and reworked it and started telling it using a blog, an email, a text message, a Facebook status. And
yes.
thought, okay, well, this is kind of a new, interesting way of telling the sequel in the style that Bram Stoker did, but using the pretext of social media. And so, therefore, that's how it came to be. And I just sort of experimented, put the one up, and just decided to see what the reaction was, and the feedback was good. And so I'm just continuing along, just plugging away. So there it is. The long-winded answer to your question.
Well, let's go back and talk a little bit. We're discussing the fact that Bram Stoker originally wrote his story in diary format, and it reminds me of Time Traveler's Wife, where, you know, basically she was writing in that type of style, diary. And when I found out they were going to make that into a movie, I thought, how in the world are they going to do that? Because, again, they would have to totally rewrite the story in order to make it any kind of, you know, diary, entries from the wife's point of view. Not sure if you've read Time Traveler's Wife, but that's how that sounds.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, and I thought, how in the world are they going to make that into a movie? So, yeah, they did well with it, but, again, they basically had to change it because they went from several points of view there.
Right. Yeah,
not just a wife's point of view, you had his point of view, because otherwise we would have never seen some of the things, you know, some of the ways in which you know, he came in and out of their lives and how he felt about that. And you know, didn't the daughters, you know, her being able to have, you know, the gift of being able to move through time, but she was able to control it. So that's, you know, just goes to show you that yes, you guess you can make something into a script, but it does take a lot of overhaul, I think.
Well, not having read the book, so how did you find, how, in comparison, the movie to the book? Having
honestly, I like the movie better. Yes, again, I'm kind of one of those people who like to find out more about the characters, and I think that if you're just writing from one point of view in diaries, you're definitely stuck in one point of view.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I can see that. Whereas, by contrast, Stoker's novel was not totally one point of view. It started off with the character of Jonathan Harker, and then we get the point of view from his fiancée, and then we got the point of view of this random doctor who at first we just think he's just a random psychiatrist treating this weird wacko patient, and they all start to get interconnected. And so you get to the different points of view, you get the telegrams going back and forth between the characters, and there were far more characters than are usually used in retelling Dracula in the movie. With the exception of Francis Ford Coppola's version, kind of used most of the characters, although he, you know, added in the love story that did not exist in the original novel. And the only point of view that we never get in the original novel is Dracula's point of view. The readers are never inside his head and what he's thinking and how he's... So it kind of adds to that, kind of making him more mysterious, because you don't know his motives, you don't know what he's up to.
Right, right.
And so I've kept that with Undead as well on what I've done online. Well, so far he's just bringing him back from the bottom of the ocean. But, you know, so there's no way, at this point, he hasn't had a chance to give a point of view. But there's everyone else's kind of, and I'm not sticking with one point of view. And I'm doing it a little bit faster and quicker than Bram Stoker's novel. Bram Stoker, you know, could spend the first three chapters and going into long exposition on the countryside of how it looks like in Transylvania and everything else, which, you know, and it makes for good reading. It's a good gothic novel, but, you know, if I'm doing this online, I decided I'm going to just make it very quick, almost suited to the episodic, like episodic television is, you know, just very quick, short scenes.
So do you actually get into the head of Dracula, and do we see his point of view?
Not at the beginning. Of course, I'm not going to say we're never going to, but it's going to be difficult to see how we're going to do that, because he is going to be in a kind of a fish out of water scenario where he has been at the bottom of the ocean for the past 70 years in a U-boat. And now, you know, the world he last saw was in World War II, and now, you know, how much has changed from 1944 to present day? So that's going to be, I'm going to have a little bit of fun with that. But still, I'm keeping him very, very much a monster, and have added the last chapter we have that's online there now has a kind of an audio clip from the U-boat during a distress signal, and you hear the attack of whatever creature they brought up from the... They don't know what they brought up, you know, from the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, and I know you got you have the prologue up, and as well as chapter 1 and 2 on your website.
Yes. Yeah, number 3 will be going up this Friday.
And explain to us the organization of your website here. For those who, because I have the, that's for those who are listening On the chat, I've got his actual direct link to the Undead -series.com. If you click on that, you can see, go directly to his homepage, and then kind of tells, yeah, because you see the image of a tablet, so explain that and how to get around in your website.
Well, the tablet is just an image, kind of weirdly came with the template of the website, and I decided to use that, being that I'm doing the whole social media thing. So that's just an image thing. But there's a start button there on the left side, I believe, and you can just click on that, and that takes you straight to the prologue. And or from the top, it says chapters. There's a drop down menu, and you can just select, you know, chapters. Therefore, if you've already been following along, you don't have to go right from the beginning. You can use the drop down menu to take you to the, you know, the latest chapter that's been posted there. So you can, and then at the end of each chapter, it links to the next one. And vice versa, at the top of each chapter, it says continued from, and linking back to the previous one, just in case you click the wrong one.
Okay, and the audio file that you have on there is of Van Helsing recording on a phonograph.
Yes, that's in the prologue.
Okay, and so what you're saying is that some of the keys that you found out and is actually being brought forward, but the actual timeline is actually current.
The timeline for these
things that you're finding, you know, you're using modern day, it says email and whatnot, and they pulled up the monster, obviously pulled up Dracula from the depths of the ocean. What year did they do that?
The setting right now is actually July 1912. So it's as if this was just a few months ago, really. You know, just about 6 months ago, whatever.
2012, right?
Yeah, 2012.
Okay.
And the communications are, you know, things with iPhone texts or Facebook. There's almost looks like a screen capture of a Facebook status, and you see the comment there. And then likewise in the next chapters, there's like a quick screen capture of a text, of a, you know, just a text on an iPhone. And so it's just those little bits just to break it up, just to kind of make it easy. So it's not a case where people have to follow the story on, you know, logging into several different social medias. It's all on the website, and it's all in chronological order going along, you know, starting from the beginning, from the prologue, continuing on, and each chapter will tell the story, and then, you know, there's an email, and then right in between an email, right after an email, there could be like a Facebook screen capture, and then right after that is just a personal blog entry, and just following it, following the story through the different points of view through correspondence. It's a different style of correspondence. And this is something when Bram Stoker was wrote his novel that was published in 1897, he was also using a lot of things that were very new as far as technology was concerned back then. Like the one character recorded all of his journals onto a phonograph. That was Dr. Seward. And so that's why we say this in the prologue, there's this old recording Van Helsing recorded on Dr. Seward's phonograph. And so we have this old, and made it sound like it was an old recording, you know. And then,
right.
And then, you know, other things like the kind of typewriter that he describes was very new in that time period. So now I'm using, you know, the technology or the tools that we have, we have one character who is visually impaired, but she does send messages, and that, you know, is one of those things I researched and found that there is an app for a person who is visually impaired to actually be able to send text messages, Braille, using Braille. And so I've, you know, incorporating that sort of thing. The U-boat, finding that in the summer, that was actually also I took straight from the news. There was recorded, they did find a U-boat, a German U-boat that was sunk just off the coast of the United States in the summer. And about a week later, they found another one off the coast of Canada. So it was one of those things that they're just, you know, they're just... they've been sitting there for the past 7 years, so I decided to use that kind of current event into the story storyline.
Yeah,
and likewise,
yeah.
Bram Stoker did that with when he had his novel. If you're familiar with it, when the Dracula arrives on the ship, the Demeter, and it crashes on the shores of Whitby, there was an actual Russian schooner, which is what he was traveling on, that had crashed on the shores of Whitby a few years earlier than what he had. Headset, and the name was very similar to what he called it in the book.
Yeah.
You know, so again, I'm kind of mirroring what he had done, even when, you know, when Dracula arrives, it's again using his thing. Suddenly, there's this huge storm, and that follows Dracula as that Russian schooner made its way to Whitby. There's this terrible storm that hit because Dracula has this control over the weather. Well, in the setting that I've set it, when it hits New York, on the day that he's brought up, July 18th, there was a freak storm that hit New York. And they had just had a heat wave, and then suddenly, on that date, this freak storm came out of nowhere, and there was flooding in some areas, and there was also hail about the size of quarters, or some even the size of golf balls coming down. So I've incorporated that into the story, just to kind of tie it into kind of in a postmodern way.
Hmm. Yeah, it's always fun to do that as authors, finding something, a thread of reality, and weaving it inside your story. As when you deal with history, you can do that.
Yeah, and me being... You know, as you recall from Depth of Deception, how much historical mm-hmm. research I put into that.
Yeah.
Even doing something that's only 6 months ago, I'm putting a lot of historical research into. You know, so it's kind of fun and ironic.
Yeah, it does make it give a sense of reality to the unreal.
Yes, exactly.
I'm going to go back a second and talk a little bit about, I have some friends who, I'm sure you might be familiar with Being Human, the TV series.
Yes.
They've got the British version and they have the American version. And I have many, either they like the American version or the British version better. Some people say that the American version is a lot bloodier and more violent. And they find that the British version is more humorous. I'm not quite sure where they get that from, but the British, you have kind of a weird sense of humor. So what do you think about the versions of the same type of story?
Well, that's actually a really interesting question, because you get that across a lot of different things, not just, of course, vampires, but you also get it, like, there's the... Sherlock Holmes, and of course he's been done in all sorts of different ways, and of course there's a very successful BBC updated version of Sherlock Holmes. That's now, I think it's into its third season, and it's very popular now. They've started an American one with Watson being a girl, also an updated modern day Sherlock Holmes. You know, it's interesting. You know, you get things like this that you're going to get a different, and it's open for different interpretations. You know, and even Dracula. There's other Dracula. I think there's another Dracula project in the works, and there's a young Dracula series which I have not actually seen yet. And like I said, there have been so many film versions of Dracula, I can't even count them. I had a book that listed them all, and it's already like woefully out of date, because there have been, you know, many since then. And And, you know, you're going to get different interpretations. Some will be good, some will be bad. And also everybody has, you know, different tastes, you know. So there will be people who will like the British version or who will maybe like that kind of humor, or people who want more gore or want more guts. I personally prefer more of the psychological, the suspense. I'm old school fan of Alfred Hitchcock, you know, and his way.
Yeah.
His reasoning, it's not the gunshot that is frightening, it's the anticipation of it.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of more how, because this is going to be a little bit more, as opposed to a television series, and this is something that I kind of reworking as I'm going along, you know, whereas I was writing, you know, special effects sequence like this, whatever special effects, and this is something I noticed from, you know, something like The X-Files or other shows, sometimes it was better not to show, because
mm-hmm.
what the audience imagined was far worse than anything that you could create with special effects or computer generation or whatever.
Jaws.
Sorry?
The movie Jaws. They didn't have the shark ready. So we never really got to see the shark until near the end.
Yeah.
And yet, it was quite scary.
Yes,
I mean,
it is. Yes. And I had watched actually a documentary on the making of that. And they tried, they had this mechanical shark, and they called it Bruce, and they tried to get it ready, and it just wouldn't. It would constantly break down, so, you know, Steven Spielberg shot around it. And, I think it's a really scary movie because you don't see. And just that those chords from John Williams, as soon as you just hear it, it just sends shivers up people's spines.
Yeah. The beginning, for instance, when the young girl is in the water and it's dark.
Yeah.
And you don't see any, I mean, there's not even any indication that there is a shark that got her. But we know that there's a shark that's got her. And that's horrendous to us that, you know, what's going on there.
And you got to give that actress credit because she's selling it. There's nothing
there.
Oh,
yeah.
It's a terrifying scene, and the way it was shot, it just looked like it was just out in the middle of absolutely nowhere in the ocean. Nobody around.
Completely on her own, naked even, you know, so she's vulnerable in every way, and here, you know, the shark's got her.
Yeah.
There's no way to get to her in time. Not that the kid, apparently he was too drunk to do anything, but, you know, that's a horrific type of scene. And again, we never did get to see the shark until near the end. And when we did see the shark, we had the great line, you know, we're going to need a bigger boat.
Yes.
And that's a great line. And you're talking about, in fact, I said something to somebody recently about Alfred Hitchcock. And he does that a lot. You don't really see, or you don't really get any answers. For instance, in Birds, the movie Birds, we never did find out why the birds went crazy.
No, actually, Alfred Hitchcock was kind of famous for doing that sort of thing. And it's what he would call the MacGuffin. And MacGuffin was what he called it. It's something that is important to all the characters, but the audience doesn't really need to know why it's important. It's just important. We have to get the microfilm. And everybody, these spies from who knows where, are trying to get the microfilm, and they will stop at nothing to get it. We never find out what's on the microfilm, but it's important to the characters.
Well, here's the curious thing about that. I don't think it would fly in this time frame anymore. Because people now, it's kind of like they've gotten smarter when it comes to, or they're more demanding on the full story. I'm not sure if that would fly anymore. I think that we would demand more of the story. I'm not sure if anybody could redo that movie.
No, probably not. And I'm totally against anybody trying to redo Hitchcock films. I think again, it all depends on how it's done or what you do. Well, even depth of deception. When I wrote the ending, and I thought people are either going to really like it or really hate it. It would be no in between, and I was surprised at from the feedback. I just people were thrown by the ending, and the feedback has been positive. They loved it. So. No one has actually wrote and said they hate the ending. If anybody has, I haven't heard yet, so they're welcome to comment. But I knew without giving it away, that it wasn't going to be totally explained.
Mhm. There you go. Well, it does open it up to perhaps do something else. Did you say you were going to do something, after that, in regards to depth
with
of deception?
With that story?
Yeah.
Not with that one. No, I'd gone on and started working on different novels. The one that I was working on. Sorry.
What you working on now?
The one that I was working on that actually hit a bit of a writer's block, and it was just more on logistics, was a story set in 1827 France, where young Victor Hugo, who's the royal poet, is caught up in, by mistaken identity, is caught up in a crime, and finds himself, kind of running for his life and trying to clear his name or hide who he is in order to not embarrass his name. And then along the way, he meets people that will come into being in his novel, that the character who inspired Javert, the really poor people. And I took this from history, that something happened in 1827 that radically changed Victor Hugo. He had been a royalist, loyal to the king, writing poems and sonnets and, odes to him. And something changed. He totally just did a complete 180 and went totally against the monarchy, writing against it, writing plays and stuff, trying to champion against the poor. And this is still, 30 years or more before he wrote Les Miserables. So it was what happened in 1827 that changed him so drastically.
Hmm.
And, even when he has his memoirs, when I looked up in his memoirs and trying to find, in 1827 what it's talking about, the only thing he mentions that year is the box office receipts for one of his plays. Isn't quite what he had hoped it to be. And that's it. I started to come up with an idea of what, of a storyline. And then started researching the history of what was happening at the time politically and with all the characters that he knew. And a story, it just sort of started to fit into place, So it's fictional, but using historical events and historical people.
Very cool. Very cool. Reminds me a little bit of, I'm sure if you got to see The Raven. It's regarding obviously a different character whatsoever, but again, taking ideas from what happened in that time period, because we don't know so many things about Edgar Allan Poe. And
right.
some things we do know. And so the author was able to, decipher some things and make up some things, which wound up being, and of course, twisted phrases a bit, I think, in order to make the story work. So, if you haven't seen it, it's something that's definitely just interesting thing to see. But that's just taking something that's already been written and finding out, as you see, a little thread of idea, which is kind of fun for an author to be able to find.
Oh, yeah, and like I said, as I was reading it through and finding people that he had been with or had interacted with, And then, you know, as I'm reading in biographies or reading things, I thought, well, you know, Victor Hugo used that historical person for the character of, you know, this in Les Miserables, or used that in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. You know, so it's been interesting in that way. And so therefore, you know, as I was writing the story and weaving it together, and also even doing the historical notes simultaneously, just so I didn't have to go back and try to find where I had it all before. So it's just been a nice little adventure that way. And this I structured to be book one of three. It would be a three book. Actually, I'd started the story in 1830, you know, of what was happening then politically. But I realized as I was working on that story, there was still I still needed to know what happened in 1827 that changed him to be what he was by 1830. And so I thought, okay, well, I have to tell that story first.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that one will be book two, you know. So that's how that's evolved. So. Yeah, so very, very different genres from going from, you know, The Depth of Deception, which was 1982, but, you know, with the Titanic murder mystery and, you know, the Dracula in present day and a young Victor Hugo in 1827. So.
Well, you think you're probably not any thread, but you have a thread of history. I mean,
yes.
you definitely like the history, and you do research based on history. And so that's something that we talked about before, and it's so important for authors and for people to appreciate who read fiction. We don't just make up stories. You have to have some kind of, especially when it comes to history, some kind of thread of reality. And that takes research.
An awful lot of research. Actually, that's sometimes it slows me down, and you can get bogged down on the research. So the research can start taking over because you really try to be accurate, you know. And I was actually on a panel at the Bloody Words conference. It's for mysteries and crime fiction in Toronto, and I was on a panel discussing historical research. And there's one person, one author talked about, you know, just how much research she had put into her novels, and she had even gone to England where she had set it, you know, and noted what flowers were there and everything else, and wrote all, you know, about the architecture and what was there and everything else. And then some botanist wrote to her, apparently she was telling me, how that one kind of flower had not been pollinated or created at the time that she had set her novel. Like, how would you know that? So there would be, you know, that somewhere, and no matter how much research you do, you know, it's almost impossible to find every little detail, and there'll be something will slip through the cracks. And you really try to do as much as you can.
Yeah, I had somebody who said, hey, that river would never go anywhere in that area of India, and I said, no, that's not true, because I actually went back and found out where that particular river actually diverted and had changed. So before that time period, it would have gone that direction. So
that's why it's good to have those kinds of
those kind of details always on the internet either. You know, I found those details in an actual encyclopedia.
Right, exactly. And that's like, even for this story of with Victor Hugo, I have to go back and find old maps. And, you know, sometimes, you know, there are maps of old Paris on the internet, but not exactly that specific time period, because with all the, and there was like several small revolutions, you know, one of which
right.
depicted, a smaller one depicted in the musical Les Miserables, but there were so many things that kept changing the face of Paris, and it was for me, it was a challenge of trying to find, you know, what streets existed, what was, it has so drastically changed, you know, even from, you know, there was one map on there that's 1836, and you don't think that from 1836 to 1827 there would be that much, that huge a change.
Right.
Well, there actually was. So, and yeah, it is tricky to try to find those little details.
So it's not so much the internet that you use, more or less you have to actually physically go and actually get the research books, you know, find these kind of details that where other people have written things in that period.
Yep. Yeah, okay. I have a bunch of books. Actually, I think I was on a blog earlier just because I had, in order to jumpstart that novel, because I had spent like about 5 months researching. And at some point, you have to go, okay, that's enough with the researching. It's time to actually start writing it.
Yeah.
And so I was took part in the NaNoWriMo back in November, the contest where you have to, the national,
yeah.
Where you have to write 50,000 words in 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I was going to use that to jumpstart it. And just before I started, I took a picture of, these are the research books I have for this story, Lutetia, and so that was, you know, and it's all different photos, different, you know, I have books that have pull-out maps, picture, you know, some old pictures of old Paris, you know, and even there's one book I have that shows a comparative that shows, see, this is how the street looks now, this is how it looked like back then, you know.
So yeah, did you make your 50,000 words?
The internet is very limiting. As expansive as it is, it is limiting. So, and always not accurate. You have to really, you know, double, triple check sometimes some of the information that's on the internet.
Yeah, and I do tell authors that all the time now. Just like, don't take your first thing. You need to, you know, if you're going to find something in the internet, it's good to find some written work somewhere that has the same information or something close to it. So, yeah. So when you wrote in NaNoWriMo, did you make your 50,000 words?
Yes, I did. I made it to the 50,000 mark the day before the last day of November, although I did not reach the end of the book. I realized as I was as reaching the 50,000, I'm not near the ending yet. it'll be closer to... 80,000 words. Not quite, but it'll be around the 80,000 mark.
Well, that's a typical size of a, you know, decent sized book.
Yeah. Which oddly, I didn't think it was going to be. I thought, you know, it would be like kind of initially when I was saying I was going to tell the 1827 story before the 1830, I thought it was going to be kind of like a little novella, like The Hobbit is to, you know, Lord of the Rings. This is just going to be the little short book before the bigger story. No, apparently not. It got to be a little more interesting as the more I researched and as the story took a life of its own.
Well, that is how it works, isn't it? I have so many authors who say, well, you know, I tell them, well, my characters tell the story, and they look at me like they have no idea what I'm talking about. And I'm going, okay, so your characters don't talk to you? And they said, no, in that case, you're not doing it right.
I totally had that with Depth of Deception, the one character, he would sometimes take the stories in areas that I had not pre-planned. And the character just went in a totally different direction than what I had planned. And, weirdly, started to, when I was doing that with this, you know, suddenly Victor Hugo would do something that, and I had to, and I would stop and go, okay, does this make sense? Would Victor Hugo actually do this? You know, and then I start doing a little bit of research, you know, and it's one, it was a little minor thing. He needed to kind of get away from the police, and so I'm having him jumping from rooftop to rooftop. I'm sure it would be hard to imagine, you know, the image you have of Victor Hugo, of him jumping from rooftop to rooftop. Well, there was this kid that he had known when he was younger, when he lived in the Latin Quarter, named Delong, who would get into trouble jumping from rooftop to rooftop. And he was a good friend of Victor Hugo. And Victor Hugo tried to correspond with him and help him in later years, not realizing he had become a criminal. And just by him doing this correspondence and reaching out to him,
incriminated him.
Victor Hugo, yeah, and he was suddenly under the watchful. And this is actual historical documentation, you know, that this happened with Victor Hugo. And he wrote this letter, and, you know, this kind of got him into trouble. And he didn't know that, you know, and didn't really fully understand the implications of him corresponding and offering him, you know, you can always come and stay with me. Well, that's harboring a fugitive. finding these little historical details where, okay, this was his friend who used to jump from rooftop to rooftop, you know, and get into trouble that way. So, okay, I'm just going to use that in the story.
That's great. Again, weaving in reality or things that really happened gives a depth of the story that I think a lot of, you know, readers really like. So,
well, I know I certainly did from, you know, the kind of books that I was influenced by, the things that the books I enjoyed. I was actually talking recently with a friend of mine who's a huge John Jakes fan, writing, who, you know, wrote early American history stuff. And I remember reading his North and South series, and how I actually, because of reading those books, I passed my American history exam, not from what I actually read in the textbook, but from what I had read in this fictionalized story of these families.
Which goes to show you must have done his research very well.
Exactly. The irony is that I almost failed history because I hated history in high school.
And now you write a lot of it.
Yes, that's the irony.
Oh, that's funny. Let's get back to your Dracula. I was wondering if you're doing it based on something going on today, which of course makes it a urban fantasy. If we have CSI, let's just kind of blue sky here for a second, as my friend Phil likes to
do. This is fine. This is kind of the feedback I've been hoping for to get from some people as I'm posting this online, and I've just been getting, you know, kind of feedbacks of people, you know, liking things, but I haven't heard anything in regards to asking specific details like this. So go ahead, yes.
Yeah, I know what you mean. People, like, they give you a one-dimensional idea of what they like about your story. Don't really tell you any in-depth things or give you any other idea that you can expand on. I hate that, but that's not the way I am.
Okay, so anyways, you were asking in regards to the...
So if we have CSI now,
yes.
Do you think that, you know, being the story based on Jesse Bram Stoker's, going in and out of, the things that he did, you know, Dracula did to the girls, to the women, I think it'd be a lot tougher for a character like Dracula to actually get away with that.
Yes, it would be in the traditional sense, obviously. Interestingly, and this was in my the 1992 series in the script, I had two detectives in the storyline who would be following and looking into this. And one detective was named Cotford, and I took this, Cotford was, and this was a page in this book, written by David Skull, as a scholar on Dracula. And he had in this book and it had to do mostly, you know, from book to screen, and talking about, you know, the evolution of Dracula from the novel to, you know, how he's portrayed on film and in theater. But in this book early on, he had this page from Stoker's actual handwritten notes. And I think this book was published in 1990. Yeah, it was around there because I was had used that as reference for the 92 series. And in there, he lists all these characters. There was a character of Kate Reed. There was this woman who's not in the novel. There was a Detective Cotford. And so he had this detective in mind to be used in the novel, but that character never appeared in it. And then he had other characters in there whom I've already started using some of those names of the characters he hasn't used. I started using in the online series, two of which appear in the prologue. And then what will be coming up pretty soon will be Cotford and Kate Reed will be investigators investigating what has happened with some murders. And however, I'm still using the mythology that Bram Stoker created. So I'm going to still continue on with the doesn't show up in reflections and unable to be photographed. So I'm still going to use that. So that's going to kind of mess things up as far as an investigation is concerned. The way it was with the little puncture wounds and the draining of the blood. Unfortunately, I think that's become a little too cliche. So it's going to be just a little bit more violent in it. But right now it has been a little more violent and gruesome only, but. You know, he's been underwater for 7 years. He's really thirsty, so he's kind of on a killing spree. And then, really, if you think about it, you know, and the murders that he committed in the book that was in the early 1890s, by comparison to what crime exists in how certain criminals are, and you know. He's kind of a little bit tame in comparison, so I'm still on the fence with how far I'm going to take him, you know, because I still want him to be a monster, but I don't want him to go. I don't want it to get too gross. So.
Yeah, well, but then again, you know, even nowadays, actually, you can get away with those kind of things, and people actually. We'll watch and listen to that kind of thing. So, as far as the gore, a little bit of gore involved in it, I think that they are a lot more, I don't know, desensitized to it now.
Right. Well, interestingly and sadly, yes, I think that's true.
Yeah.
Although, like I said, the as far as like we were talking about earlier, you know, leaving some things to the imagination, you know, in the last chapter that was there, you heard there was a distress call from the ship that's brought the U-boat, the crate up from the U-boat, and you know, you hear the attack of the person, but of course, you know, that's leaving it to the imagination, and then you know, kind of giving a sneak preview to the upcoming chapter, there is going to be a video clip of an attack.
Somebody got a video of it.
Yeah.
Huh.
But again, he doesn't show up on camera.
Right. So you just see the people kind of flinging, you know, something has a hold of them. They're screaming and then they fling them after, you know, after they're done with them.
Something like, yeah, it's kind of stylized. It's very, I liken it to kind of a Blair Witch kind of shot. So we're in the woods at night, so.
Ah, okay. Yeah, there you go. So I think it's interesting how you have taken the idea and modernized it. But I'm thinking that you designed this originally in the 1990s.
Yes.
So, do you think did you have to actually bring it even to date because of that?
Yeah, I did because there was one character who I had kind of as a descendant of the Westenra family from the original novel, because it was mentioned in the book that there was a distant relative. So I have that this lineage is from that distant relative, but they're still wealthy. And to show the wealth, you know, in the script, she had a car phone, you know, back in 1992. So that just sounds like, you know, she had a lot of money. Because in 1992, not everybody had, you know, mobile phones. It was still relatively new. Of course, you know, I'm reading that in my pilot script going, yeah, that just looks so lame now. So, yeah, you know, now, of course, everybody has a phone or a mobile device, you know, almost everybody.
But right.
It's very commonplace now. It's, you know, you can't even find a payphone anymore, you know, around here.
Yeah.
Everybody has the, you know, I went, you know, last time I was in New York, I went to see a show in the theater, and they have the phone booths there still in the lobby, but there's no phone in it.
Yeah.
And so making changes like that, you know, sort of some things had to be updated. You know, even in writing it back in 92, DNA was still only, you know, as far as being used as science in crime, it was only 5 years old at that point.
Right.
You know, so it was, that was still a new science that didn't even touch on in the old, in my TV scripts initially. And that, and it's like you were asked about the whole CSI thing. Well, yeah, that's going to have to come in. The forensics and criminology is going to have to come into the story, and it's going to be a little bit different.
There's a little more modern
update.
Yeah, and here it's only been, you know, 10 years, but it's definitely things that have changed within the last 10 years. Like the guy who just got off after being in prison for quite a while for a crime he didn't commit, finally being able to be exonerated because of DNA that they found to be not his. So.
Yes. There's been quite a few cases like that here in Canada too, and but yeah, so it's little things like that, you know, like sort of as far as the technology, but the communications has exploded, and since again the Stoker's novel was all about how people were communicating back then, I'm using the communication style of today to now tell the story. And again, everybody will have a little bit of the puzzle, but not everybody has the complete puzzle.
Oh,
and,
right.
And readers reading along online, and every week or so we'll update the story, and you know, the readers will, of course, they know what Dracula is. They know what Dracula
right.
Was and is, but you know, as far as these characters are concerned, they, first of all, to believe that vampires exist, that's fiction, you know, it's got to be something more logical than that.
Right, so you're taking urban fantasy then, because
yeah.
that's taking a fiction of character like Dracula and bring him into our reality. What city exactly are you coming into? New York, or is that
yes,
the ship coming in?
Yeah, I'm setting a good chunk of it in New York.
Okay, and I know you're from Toronto. Are you living in Canada?
Yes, I am. Although I have spent. I've been to New York actually for a while there. I was like there almost every other month. And again, back to the old research stuff. And actually, I'm looking at it right now. I have this book on New York and some of the old subway system that existed and some of the old tunnels. Because I'm taking again with Dracula, I'm putting him underground. So. You know, so I've done some research to a bit of old New York as well.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I've done a lot of research on old New York. So.
So you went to New York to find out a lot of that information in the library, sir?
No, I actually. Well, I picked up some books while I was down in New York the last time. So. And. And yeah, and I have friends in New York, and even when I'm working on Depth of Deception, you know, and other stories, it's, you know, the whole communication system is great, because I would sometimes, because Depth of Deception was set in New York, but in the 80s. But I would occasionally, you know, just email some friends and say, okay, I need to find out something. And it wasn't just even in New York; it was also things in England as well. You know, somebody had posted they were in England, and actually even working on the Victor Hugo story. Somebody was in Paris on, and they posted pictures on Facebook, and I said, "Are you there right now? Can you go and look something up for me?" So the whole social networking and the way of reaching out and finding things through people, you know, I said, I need a picture of this. And people are really helpful that way. You know, at least my friends have been, you know. So it's
that does come in handy. I had an author just told me today that in order to get some information about Nepal, he actually talked to some Nepalese where he could do certain scenes from his book. So
right.
He was in contact with them, you know, back and forth throughout in order to get some research that you wouldn't normally get from books. Because, again, that's a part of the world that we don't really know as much about. So he plans actually going to Nepal in a few months from now. And he's going to take these people out to dinner to help them with the research.
Well, that's actually very, very good of him. And yeah, you know, it's what a interesting opportunity and experience for helping him in that. You know, like you said,
it's
not something that anybody else would have access to or been able to find out just, you know, from the comfort of their home, you know, without having that kind of assistance.
Exactly. I mean, that's what Facebook kind of does for us, is it brings you know, other parts of the world closer to us.
And that's kind of what I'm playing with the Undead series. So it's going to be kind of fun, and it will be challenging, because, like you said, there will be some things that's like, okay, we need to... It's the world is smaller now as a result of this, you know.
Yeah.
Things get, you know,
communications
get a lot faster. You know, when Stoker wrote his novel in the 1890s, you know, the telegram was the fast way of sending something, you know. And I don't even think does anybody even use a telegram anymore? I don't even know if a telegram companies are in existence
anymore. It's in history now.
Yeah.
I have a special question from Cloud Nation Radio, and they're asking, how's the market for short story fiction and nonfiction novellas?
How is the market for it? That's a good question. I don't know how good it is. I have a short story that's on Amazon called Same Crime Tomorrow, and I had adapted that also from something I had wrote as a short film. And short films don't make money at all; they really don't. And this short film would have been so expensive to shoot that everyone said it's a cool idea. When are you going to shoot it? It was going to cost over $100,000 to shoot it, and that's with everybody donating their time, you know, on it. And so I wrote it as a little short story, and then, you know, like changed the narrative style and put it up there on Amazon. And it's done okay. It's not a big seller, although you're only going to put so much money into publicizing something that's, you know, only like 14 pages long, if
right.
that. Whereas Depth of Deception, you know, has still been constantly still doing well. it's not enough for me to, you know, retire or anything on just yet. But, you know, I'm still hoping to see the numbers go up faster. I don't see that it has been. Now, I have another short story, Remember Me, and it's in part of an anthology. And it's also on through Amazon, but I don't have the numbers on how well that has been doing, as far as the anthology books. So I'm not sure how well that is from my own personal experience. You know, it hasn't been that staggering. Mm-hmm. Now Undead, the way I'm doing it, it is. It's different. I don't even know if other people have done anything like this. I know people have posted short stories or gone chapter by chapter on sites like Wattpad or other sites like that, which are things that are work in progress or something like that.
But you're using mixed media in order to actually bring your story.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I put the prologue on there. But I even had to say, unfortunately, you can't see this picture that they're making reference to here. I have to go to the website. So using the mixed media, like I said, I don't know if that has been done before. This is kind of, I don't know, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is kind of new territory. You know, the internet's been around for last 10 plus years, but as far as being able to tell the story like this, and actually I had considered doing something like this, not with this one, but more with the original novel, you know, just putting, you know, like, here's the letter, here's the telegram, that sort of thing. And I was creating kind of JPEG and GIF images of stuff. And, you know, this was back in 97 during the centennial anniversary of Dracula. And the internet, most people are on dial-up, and the internet bandwidth was much smaller, and it just took forever to download one image. So it's like, okay, well, this is not going to work. And, you know, in such a short amount of time, you know, so much has changed as far as what can get out there and what's posted. And, you know, even the each chapter so far has, you know, either has, you know, has broken up with text, and then we'll have an image, or there's some photos, and I'm using even photos from previous Dracula things I have worked on production wise, you know, I had to contact the actress who played Lucy Westenra and Mina Harker from a different thing to say, okay, here's this publicity picture we took, do you mind if I use this for this as this old photo that they found? No, go ahead. So there we go.
Okay.
You know, so you
did have to get some permission to use some of your historical stuff, even if it had something to do with the original movie.
There were definitely, like, for example, that photo, because I was using it, this is the photo that we have, that I'm, it's going to be part of the story, and it's going to be incorporated into it, so I did want to get permission to do that. I also used, in the last chapter, I used a photo that I was able to get permission for of a storm hitting New York, but I still needed to put the photo credit at the bottom. So at the bottom of the page, I had to give the photo credit for that sort of thing. A lot of other things I created myself. So some of the other images or the text message, the character names. So those are all fictional.
Yeah, I would normally ask you if you consider putting some of your nonfiction, you know, the things that you found out, and putting into a smaller story, not story, but a smaller book, kind of give the idea of what things that you found. But I think what you're doing is you're using a lot of that and actually incorporating into your mixed media.
Yeah, totally. So that's exactly, and that's been part of the fun and part of the what's made this a kind of an interesting project to work on. And it's just, for me, it's great because I had this story from 20 years ago that has been just sitting on my shelf for a long time. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, there's a little section in the on the website. There's about, and it has a little bit of a history, some of which I have talked about here already. One of the things, and I have an image there under the about, the old floppy disk that I had the files on, that I had the pilot script on. So I had to get that whole script off of a floppy disk, and it's fortunately I still have a computer that has a floppy drive in it. But it's good luck finding. You know, it's a good thing I'm doing this now, because you know, in another 5 years, I don't think you'll be able to find anything like that. So because definitely you can't buy a computer now with a floppy drive.
No. You have to go back again. Something that you've been using for a doorstop, you know.
Yes, exactly. And literally, and that, the other thing I didn't get into on the side, but I suddenly, you know, I went to log on, you know, and this is, I'm sure you can relate, when you're a writer, you get very paranoid someone's going to steal your idea. And so yeah. I had this document password protected.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I have to think of what password did I have 20 years ago.
yeah.
And it took me all day to figure this out, and I even called friends, you know, one of my oldest friends. Okay, you know, he started asking me questions. Okay, who did we know then? What were we doing then? What kind of job? What job were you at then? And of course, it was none of that. It was so much more obscure. So, for me, it's good. I'm finishing my original thought because I digress here, as you noticed. It's been interesting to get this off the shelf and actually put the story out there, you know. You know, rather than it just, you know, sitting there. And so it's given it some life in a very interesting and kind of creative. And it's been kind of fun doing this. And there's even for the video.
I lost him. Hang on a second. We lost Alexander. So, let's see if he notices. Can't move, buddy. Let's see if he notices here and called us back. He just suddenly dropped off. Let me make sure mine's working. Yeah, it's definitely not on my end. We lost him suddenly. And sometimes that happens with telephones. So, until he calls back, I didn't write down his number, of course. Oh, there he is. We lost you.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what happened to there.
I'm going like, is it me? I was going like, no, mine's running fine. That suddenly just totally dropped.
Yeah. and this time, like, because last time I was talking to you on a cell phone. This time I used using a landline, so it didn't, you know, because I noticed you know the volume kept dropping in and out when I was talking to you last time.
Yeah, it always depends on a lot of things. You know, the phone lines you're using. There's just long distance between you and me. I'm in Arizona.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's true.
So we were talking about the mixed media and that you're using, and how it's interesting how you're using the different things and able to use nonfiction ideas and in order to bring that to reality. So it's really great. I'm not sure where we were.
That was pretty much where we were. Here for a moment. What was my train of thought before that? I totally lost where I had been. I think I was just talking about that it's been kind of nice just to bring it back and give it life again,
yeah.
Rather than it just sitting doing nothing. So,
Now, did it take any Kickstarter program or any amount of money that to be able to bring this mixed media into a reality did you just need a website and some ideas?
That's totally what I've done now. You know, I'm actually incorporating a lot of things that from, you know, because I used to do, had done graphics and I created props and stuff for the film industry and for theater. And, you know, so I'm, you know, so creating, you know, props and things that that I'm photographing or that we have online, you know, so it's a lot of that sort of thing, photoshopping stuff. I'm using some of my own background into it, like sort of my own past history, so to speak, and then using some of the other, like I said, that photograph that we had done from a Dracula stage production, and then there was a publicity, like I said, it was a publicity photo for a Dracula stage production, but I'm using it now, like this is this old photo. And I aged it to look like an old photo, as opposed to we just had a really nice picture, you know, when we had it back when I had taken it originally. And then I even went back to some of the promo video stuff, and there's certain things that I might be able to use some of that stuff. So it's things that I had already paid money in. Back in 92, when we had shot this, so using that sort of thing. But as far as creating the website, it was the registering the domain name, but any of the stuff that's pretty much on there, it hasn't required a lot of capital on my end, which has been very good, because I really, you know, don't want to be doing that sort of thing right now, you know. And then we'll see, you know, how things go, you know, as far as the viewership or readership goes, so to speak, you know, what's going to happen as far as how it's going to evolve, you know.
It's interesting that you have, just to let everybody know, on your website, you have things that you can sell. You got your logo, which is an interesting logo, by the way.
Thank you.
And you've got them on T-shirts and coffee mugs.
Well, that was just one of those things we thought, well, let's had that for something like that for when we did one of the stage productions, and it was kind of a fun thing. The logo did turn out quite nicely. If anyone, I think you had it there on the top of the web page that you could see. It's the it looked like a bat, but the word undead with the hyphen is actually hidden in that bat.
I noticed that. I do know that you said something about the other logo that you used with the rose, and actually says rose on it, which I did figure out. But you had a couple other words in there that I didn't see. I'm going like, where are the words? I could see rose. I couldn't see the other one.
The trick is, the little hint I'll give you here. The word rose is totally with just the rose. The word cross is hidden in the cross. So,
okay.
The one that most people have trouble finding is the R in cross, and you kind of have to tilt your head sideways to see to the left to see the R. So,
I did try that. I turned the head the wrong direction.
The R is the tricky one, but it's all very intricate. So and my wife, Carmen Gillespie, she was the illustrator, and she did the both logos. Sorry, you're cutting out there. I just couldn't hear you there. Hello? Sorry, I'm having trouble. I can hear you, but not, I can't hear what you're saying. No, I'm still Trying to see if there's something here on my end. Hello?
Are you there?
Yeah, there you are. Okay.
Okay. I unplugged it and plugged it back in. Maybe it's just, I don't know. Sometimes you just take unplugging it, you know? So I was saying that your wife is a graphic designer and we have something in common.
Oh, excellent. Yes. Yeah, she's a talented illustrator and yeah, it turned out quite nice. So thought, well, we got to use that. So and so it like that, the Rosen Cross has already been incorporated a couple of times, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In the story already, it's been on in a wax seal and in the and burnt into this old box, and so again, that goes back to my old the whole graphics and props building background I have. So
now under the about, everyone needs to, I'm going to save that and give that. Because if you scroll down, everyone, there's a bunch of pictures down below. And you've got some, obviously, stage shows and things like that from other episodes. 1997, 2001, and in 1999 even, and then back up to 2008, which is... you're on the undead. Oh, is that the picture 2013 of the disc that you had to get your?
Yes.
He actually has a picture of the floppy disc that we were just talking about.
Yeah.
That's great. And then that's great.
Sorry, what was that?
It says Victorian monograms on. The style of the Rosen Cross and the undead map. Yeah.
So the Rosen Cross Society is something that I've created just for this series. That'll be like a secret society that was formed after the. Actually, I think I have it from before. That is formed in. They know about the vampires, but the rest of the world doesn't. So.
So tell us about your characters.
So far we have the characters we've introduced thus far is Dicis Harker, who is aspiring to be a writer. Again, and I've kind of mirrored that to Mina Harker from the original novel, who was also aspiring to be a writer and was kind of a school mistress, but gave it up to be a dutiful wife. Unlike Mina, this one has no romantic attachments at the moment. We have her friend, Judy Westenra, who's a little well off, whereas Dicis is a struggling student and has had to save up money to go to England, where she was trying to find out a little bit about her family and found nothing, except some old photos. And
Alexander, I just realized, We're almost at the time that we're supposed to be off.
Okay.
We've got 1 minute and 45 seconds to say goodbye to you.
Okay.
It says, it was such a great conversation that we just, kept going. We've got to do this again sometime, okay? Once we get the video fixed, we'll go ahead and do something about that and do a short video interview with you, okay?
That'll be terrific.
That'd be great.
And, yes, and speaking of video, there will be a video in this upcoming chapter, so there'll be a small video clip so people can look for that.
I'm looking forward to that.
All right.
So I want to say good night, and thanks so much for coming on with me.
Well, thank you very much for having me again on the interview. So I appreciate that.
No problem. And again, I'll be sending you the embedded codes that way you can do whatever you want with it, okay?
All right. Well, terrific. Thank you very much, and good night to everyone.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Happy reading.
Definitely. That was Alexander Gallant, and we're so happy to have him on board. We have something going on next week. We'll be putting that up pretty soon here, and definitely have another one coming up the week after that. So we've got a couple shows per day, per week coming up. So definitely check online on KWOD Radio. And this is Patty Holstrand signing out for the day, and you guys have a great night.